skills as
Or you
part
can
of.
just pass it on to me. So
Okay.
why don't you introduce yourself?
All right.
Say that this is, well, I don't know how you want to do it. You want to introduce the title and then yourself, and then I'll say, and I'm Daniel Coyne.
Yeah, well, yeah, you can do that.
And then I'll pass it back to you, and you'll start with the let's begin the discussion, and then you can.
Okay, and you can do the thanks for joining us today. Okay.
Yeah, and I thought most of these bullets, I mean, we kind of do like a couple each.
Yeah, that's what I figured.
Wandered, you know, maybe if we've talked a long time, we'll stop and the other one can take up the next one, but probably a couple bullets for each of us, and we just keep moving that way.
Yep. Or, you know, if you're done and you want me to pick up, you can always say Jay, and I can say Dan, and then that's your cue to.
Yeah.
Start with the next bullet.
Okay.
That makes it more conversational.
Yeah, I think that's what we're going for, that back and forth dialogue.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay.
If we're ready, Kate, why don't you and I mute? And gentlemen, when you're ready, you may begin.
Thank you for joining this CME CE podcast activity titled The Mechanisms and Role of HIF-PHIs in patients with CKD and anemia, advances in the therapeutic landscape. I'm Jay Wish, and I'm professor of clinical medicine at Indiana University School of Medicine and chief medical officer for dialysis at Indiana University Health in Indianapolis, Indiana.
And I'm Dr. Daniel Coyne. I'm at Washington University in St. Louis, where I'm a professor of medicine and the medical director of our academic dialysis unit, Cromalloy American Kidney Center, and the medical director of the medicine multi-specialty clinics at the university.
Thanks for joining us today. We have a great program in store for you. We'll be discussing the burden and pathogenesis of anemia and CKD and exploring new and emerging therapies. Let's begin this discussion with the challenges faced by patients with CKD anemia. Dan?
Well, let's first talk about how common it is. When you look at patients who have stage 1 or 2 CKD, anemia is relatively infrequent. Only about 8% of those patients will have anemia, and it'll typically be quite mild. But by the time you progress to stage 5 CKD patients who are not on dialysis yet, 53.4% of those patients qualify as being classified as anemic, and many of those may start to be receiving therapies to treat their anemia prior to getting to stage 5.
The reason we worry about anemia in our patients is because it has significant impact on their quality of life, which includes work productivity, as well as having an impact on their heart outcomes. We know that the presence of anemia correlates with a high rate of cardiovascular events with a significantly higher risk of death, as well as an increased risk of cardiovascular hospitalizations, as well as progression to ESRD compared to non-anemic patients with CKD.
Yeah, and as you and I both know, Jay, quality of life is difficult to quantify in our patients, but we certainly see our share of patients who become more fatigued, have more difficulty working a full work schedule as they become more anemic. And in at least a significant proportion of these patients, treatment of their anemia and possibly iron deficiency leads to better functional status. Whether it changes long-term outcomes like reduces cardiovascular events or mortality has not been proven in the studies using ESAs or ESAs, but we may see some data with other products.
It's also difficult to tease out the effects of anemia on quality of life versus the effects of the CKD itself. And that's why there will be a significant percentage of patients who may not have an important increase in their quality of life after treatment for their anemia. The other problem with anemia is that it's often insidious because it's so slowly progressive. The patients adapt to it. They don't even realize they have symptoms from it. And sometimes it takes some questioning on the part of the healthcare practitioner to actually get the patient to tell you that they don't feel as well or as energetic as they did maybe a year or two ago.
So Jay, I had mentioned treating some of the patients, and one of the main treatments we use, more so in dialysis than non-dialysis patients, are ESAs, or erythropoiesis stimulating agents, like EPO or darbepoetin. Some patients are hyporesponsive to this. What's your definition of hyporesponsiveness, and why is it important for our CKD and dialysis patients?
Well, ESA hyporesponsiveness has been defined in a variety of ways depending upon the study and the author of the article. It's generally, however, seen as a failure to achieve target hemoglobin levels at high ESA doses. So you can quantify that in terms of the, you know, milligrams or units per kilogram body weight of the ESA, or in terms of ESA responsiveness index. But the bottom line is that you're throwing more and more ESA at a patient and they don't raise their hemoglobin to the target range, which is generally somewhere in the 10 to 11 range.
Yeah.
This is important not only because the patients continue to have the poor quality of life associated with their persistent anemia, but it's been shown that ESA hyporesponsiveness itself is a marker for bad outcomes. And that's probably because of the underlying pathophysiology of the ESA hyporesponsiveness, which relates to an inflammatory state, which is probably the cause of the bad outcome in the first place.
The only thing I'd add to that, Jay, is that given the definition used, at least in the research trials, some of the patients do reach their target hemoglobin, but they're on very large doses of ESAs. So they're expensive to treat. And as you alluded to, that high ESA dose is actually a biomarker of sorts for increased cardiovascular events and increased risk of death in those patients. So identifying these hyporesponders in our population should alert us to the fact that they're at greater risk of these outcomes.
Absolutely. And if you look at a typical dialysis population, it's estimated that somewhere between 10, 15, maybe even 20% of patients will have the defining characteristics of ESA hyperresponsiveness. And I think it's very important in that subset to be particularly vigilant in trying to explore what the underlying inflammatory condition might be. Is it a dialysis catheter? Is it diabetic foot ulcers that aren't being adequately addressed? There's a whole bunch of things that we really need to look into in those patients to try to get at the root cause of the hypo-hyperresponsiveness rather than just continuing to escalate the ESA dose.
So why do CKD patients get anemic, beginning typically in stage 3 CKD, and why does it worsen over time?
Well, it used to be thought that the anemia of chronic kidney disease was simply a state of EPO, or obviously therapeutic ESA, under production. That, you know, like a patient with type 1 diabetes, it was a lack of a hormone, in this case erythropoietin, and that by giving back the hormone through a recombinant human form, you could basically solve the problem, replace the missing hormone, get the hemoglobin back up to an acceptable range, improve quality of life, decrease transfusions, and the patients would do well. And obviously, with over 30 years experience with ESAs, we realize that things aren't quite that simple, that the anemia of chronic kidney disease is actually multifactorial and is due not only to a relative decrease in erythropoietin as compared to normal populations for any given hemoglobin level, but also abnormal iron metabolism, which is probably again related to the underlying inflammatory condition, uremic suppression of red cell synthesis, blood loss because of the dialysis procedure or because of increased GI bleeding. And I think it's very important that when we approach a patient with anemia of chronic kidney disease, we explore all of those possibilities and rule out iron deficiency, vitamin deficiency, inflammatory disease, et cetera, and then consider ESA replacement as kind of a last resort once all those other things have been addressed.
And certainly our guidelines in nephrology now recommend that the first treatment, if anything, is to replete the patient's iron stores. So patients with progressive CKD frequently are iron deficient. Our markers for iron deficiency are predominantly helpful when they're both low and indicate iron deficiency. But when they become somewhat higher, they're actually non-diagnostic of whether the patient's iron deficient or not. But why don't you talk for a minute about the role of hepcidin in the development and sustaining iron deficiency, and why it's more than just iron deficient patients who don't make enough EPO?
Well, hepcidin is a relatively recent discovery. It was discovered around 2000, and it's now understood to be the master hormone, if you will, in terms of iron regulation. It's produced by the liver in response to inflammatory cytokines, in particular IL-6, as well as excess iron in the body. And it is our major defense against iron overload, as well as being a defense against iron availability to invading microorganisms. Many microorganisms, particularly bacteria and fungi, are siderophilic, and the locking up of iron from the circulation is an important host defense in the presence of some of these infections. So we evolved this mechanism, hepcidin, to prevent iron overload, because excessive iron absorption from the GI tract leads to hemochromatosis, because there's no natural mechanism to get rid of iron, as well as the ability to sequester iron in the presence of infection. Now, infection is an inflammatory state, and as it turns out, all inflammatory states lead to an increase in hepcidin. So whether or not the patient is infected in the setting of chronic kidney disease really isn't the major issue, is because chronic kidney disease itself is an inflammatory state leading to an increase in hepcidin. And there's been a variety of studies that demonstrate almost a linear increase in hepcidin levels as GFR declines from normal to stage 5 chronic kidney disease. Ultimately, what hepcidin does is close the ferroportin channel that allows iron export from macrophage storage cells and duodenal enterocytes. So by trapping the iron in the cells, it makes it less available to the circulation, less available to be exported to transferrin, to be brought to the erythroid bone marrow and support red blood cell production. So this is what we call functional iron deficiency. The patient is not absolutely iron deficient insofar as that there are actually iron stores in the body, but it's functionally iron deficient because those iron stores aren't being released, delivered to the bone marrow. And as far as the bone marrow is concerned, the patient is iron deficient.
I think it's worth also pointing out, though, that some of these patients actually are absolutely iron deficient. So that increase in hepcidin that you talk about, that's mediated through IL-6 and other inflammatory cytokines, can occur in patients who have progressive blood loss and become more iron deficient. And so in some of these patients, we will see high hepcidin levels if we were to measure them. We don't clinically measure them. We'll see high ferritins, because that also is a responsive element to inflammation. But in fact, their iron stores are absent. So in both those cases, absolute and functional iron deficiency, treatment with iron therapy appears to improve anemia to an extent. It doesn't really correct it.
Well, it may actually correct the anemia in patients who have absolute iron deficiency, and especially patients with earlier stages of chronic kidney disease, where the predominant mechanism of iron deficiency may be more absolute than functional because their hepcidin levels aren't that elevated. Many of those patients do, in fact, have very low iron stores, have transferrin saturations in the single digits, ferritins less than 50, and a gram of intravenous iron is often associated with a significant rise in their hemoglobin levels back towards the normal range.
However, in a study by Stanku of 100 anemic CKD 4 and 5 patients who had never received IV iron or ESA therapy, 50% of them had absolute iron deficiency. And while a gram of iron did make the vast majority of those patients increase their hemoglobin substantially, few of them got back to normal hemoglobins. So we're still left with, there is an important component of EPO under response in the setting of CKD. So with that, why don't we talk about the HIF pathway and what does that have to do with functional iron deficiency and EPO levels that are too low for the degree of anemia present in our patients?
Well, HIF stands for hypoxia-inducible factor. And this is a very important discovery that occurred again around 2000. So that was kind of a breakthrough period in terms of our understanding of the pathophysiology of anemia in patients with chronic kidney disease. So HIF, hypoxia-inducible factor, is a factor, if you will, that actually has two subunits, an alpha subunit and a beta subunit. The alpha subunit is continuously produced, but in the presence of oxygen, there is an enzyme called prolyl hydroxylase, which rapidly degrades HIF alpha and prevents its dimerization with HIF beta. The HIF alpha beta dimer goes into the nucleus and is responsible for the transcription of a variety of anemia related genes, erythropoietin, the erythropoietin receptor, transferrin, the transferrin receptor, and a number of iron transport proteins, duodenal cytochrome B, dimethyl transporter 1, ceruloplasmin. And it really is important because this leads to not only increase in erythropoietin levels, but the activation of the HIF pathway ultimately leads to a more coordinated response to anemia, because you're not only increasing erythropoietin, but also you're increasing the transport of iron to the bone marrow where it's needed to support the synthesis of hemoglobin and ultimately the production of mature red cells. So this foundation became the basis for the development of a variety of therapies which potentiate the HIF alpha, allowing it to dimerize with HIF beta by inhibiting the prolyl hydroxylase enzyme. So this is important, not in terms of our understanding of the physiology, but as the basis for a new form of therapy for anemia.
And those agents are interesting. So now we're talking about the HIF prolyl hydroxylase inhibitors, or HIF PHIs. Roxadustat is the first of these agents to complete the phase 3 trials and has a PDUFA date of March 20th, 2021, when we'll hear from the FDA about whether this drug is approved for clinical use in the United States. It's already been approved in China and Japan. Vadadustat and daprodustat are also drugs that have gone through phase 3 trials. Vadadustat has reported some of their results. Daprodustat has recently completed their trials. We know that, like vadadustat, it's as efficacious as ESAs for correcting hemoglobin in CKD and dialysis populations. But we do not have the safety data yet out on daprodustat. How do these small molecules work, Jay, and how are they administered?
Well, because they're not large proteins like ESAs that have to be administered parenterally, the HIF stabilizers, as you point out, are small molecules that can be given orally. And obviously, for patients with non-dialysis CKD or those who are on home dialysis, this can be a major advantage because they don't have to come to a healthcare facility to get injections as they would with ESAs. So the patient friendliness in terms of the route of administration, I feel, is a major advantage of these drugs. As I pointed out before, unlike ESAs, which only replace the decreased erythropoietin, the HIF stabilizers have multiple effects on multiple genes that are related to erythropoiesis. So in so far as they stimulate a lot of those other proteins involved in iron transport and serum ferritin, and the fact that they indirectly suppress hepcidin levels, you have a much better, as I said, coordination of erythropoiesis with the HIF stabilizers than you do with the ESAs. So this may give you potential advantages in those ESA-resistant patients that we talked about, the hyporesponsive patients who have inflammation, functional iron deficiency, high hepcidin levels, because the reduction in the hepcidin and the increased transcription of iron-related proteins is important in overcoming this ESA resistance.
And certainly in the information we've received so far with roxadustat, we see that the EPO-resistant patients respond quite well to roxadustat. It corrects the anemia and seems to mobilize the iron as well as it does in people who are not inflamed and on ESA therapy. It's interesting to think that this drug is fundamentally working different. It's increasing the endogenous EPO levels much less than we mimic with our pharmacologic injections of ESAs, but can mobilize the iron to support that erythropoiesis throughout the treatment period. What are some of the disadvantages? If the advantages are oral drug, you can titrate to hemoglobin goal easily, you can mobilize more iron and potentially have less IV iron requirements in the patient. Responsive and ESA resistant patients, what are some of the potential disadvantages or at least concerns about these agents?
Well, the concerns are their mechanism of action, which is to mimic a hypoxic state in the cell. So this, as we said, increases the transcription of a variety of proteins, or I should say a variety of genes that synthesize proteins that are related to the hypoxic response. So the ones that we want to stimulate, those are related to erythropoiesis and iron transport. You know, those are great. That's what we want to achieve. But there's also the potential to transcribe other factors that are related to the cellular hypoxic response. These may include those related to angiogenesis. So it's possible that it could accelerate diabetic retinopathy or increase tumor growth. There may be increased fibrosis because one of the responses to hypoxia may be for that tissue to basically shut down because it just can't survive in the hypoxic environment. And there's also a concern raised by some regarding thromboembolic complications and even CKD progression because of renal fibrogenesis. One other thing that was a surprise that was observed in some of the phase 2 and phase 3 studies and really remains unexplained is an increased incidence of hyperkalemia among patients treated with the HIF stabilizers, roxadustat in particular, versus standard of care, which would be ESA. So, you know, I think we still have a lot to learn about these drugs. Many of these theoretical disadvantages have not shown up in large-scale global clinical trials. In fact, there were sub-analyses of the roxadustat clinical trials which clearly did not show increases in diabetic retinopathy or increases in neoplasms. So that is somewhat comforting, but again, it may take more than a typical 3-year phase 3 study to be completely certain that these adverse events will not occur.
Yeah, and just to give a little more depth to that, the Japanese studies in particular focused on diabetic retinopathy and carefully monitored the patients throughout the treatment period and could not show any increased incidence of worsening retinopathy in the patients treated with the HIF-PHI versus darbepoetin therapy. The cancer therapy you allude to, I think we'll talk about that a little bit more when we get into the safety data out of the phase 3 studies, because there are still some concerns there. I should point out the thrombo...
You may have to stop. I forgot to stop my clock. Hold on. It's probably too late. You probably heard it gong.
I didn't hear it.
All right. Sorry about that. All right, Dan, you want to pick up with the neoplasms?
Yeah, if you can go back.
Thromboembolic, sorry.
I was just going to say, if you can go back to the previous point and pick up, and I'll be now.
I think another point about thromboembolism is the thought with ESA's increasing thromboembolic events was that it was simply a matter, they were raising hemoglobin, sometimes we were overshooting, and that both of these factors were actually contributing to more thromboembolic events. So that's something that can be examined in the placebo versus active drug therapy, such as the roxadustat CKD trial, when we really look at some of the safety data. So Jay, why don't we talk about the phase three trials, beginning with the roxadustat trials. Those are the trials that have been completed the longest. The PDUFA date for roxadustat, hearing back from the FDA and learning whether they're approved for marketing in the US is March 20th, 2021. Tell me about the efficacy data for this and for that matter, for all these products.
Okay, well, not surprisingly, all of the phase three studies that we have results from, namely roxadustat and vadadustat, have shown efficacy that is pretty well comparable to the ESA comparator when ESAs were used in the other arm of the study. And Roxa did a placebo comparator in their non-dialysis CKD study. And as might be expected, there was greater efficacy in terms of hemoglobin rise among the patients receiving roxadustat versus versus placebo. There has been some,
Jay, and I think daprodustat has already announced that their phase three trials have met all of their efficacy endpoints.
Okay.
I don't know that we have the details.
I stand corrected. All right. You want me to say it again? I didn't see that. Was that a press release?
I think they released and said that they their efficacy and, you know, they're obviously working on the other stuff.
Okay. I can start again.
We don't have to start again. Right. You said those two. I don't know if they can edit it out. What do you want to do? Media man.
If you wouldn't mind just picking it up.
Okay.
Just make sure you have it. Thank you.
All right. So you asked me about efficacy.
Yes. Right.
So as far as efficacy for these agents is concerned, we do have results of phase three clinical trials with roxadustat, which is starting to appear in peer-reviewed publications. Vadadustat, which has been reported as top-line data, as well as data at the 2020 ASN Kidney Week. And then daprodustat, where there are also top-line efficacy data reported. For roxadustat in patients who are not on dialysis, where the comparator was placebo, there was superior efficacy in raising the hemoglobin compared to placebo. In the roxadustat dialysis patients, where the comparator was ESA, there was comparable efficacy in terms of the rise in the hemoglobin over the outcome study period. For vadadustat, where the comparator was ESA in both the non-dialysis and the dialysis studies, the efficacy in terms of hemoglobin rise was comparable, non-inferior to that of the ESA. And the top-line data that have been reported with daprodustat is that it has met all of its efficacy targets.
So we know it can nail the efficacy, and it really now comes down to how is the safety of these products compared to our gold standard treatment right now, which is ESAs. So Jay, do you want to talk about the roxadustat phase three trials?
Sure. So roxadustat, as we said, was tested in phase three studies for both non-dialysis and dialysis patients. In the non-dialysis patients, as we said, the comparator was placebo. And as it turns out, when you look out at the pool data for the three major trials, Olympus, Alps, and Andes, there was no difference from placebo in terms of MACE, MACE plus, all-cause mortality, myocardial infarction, stroke, or unstable angina. If you look at the dialysis studies for roxadustat, where the comparator was epoetin alpha, there was no difference in MACE or MACE plus among the entire dialysis population. When you look specifically at the incident dialysis population, who were defined as patients who were randomized within their first 4 months of dialysis, there was actually MACE superiority, MACE plus superiority, as compared to ESAs.
And Jay, what was the median effect in that group? Because that's an important group. Our incident dialysis patients have an enormous mortality. The death rate is very high in the first 90 days, and for the first year is substantially higher than subsequent years on dialysis.
Absolutely. This is probably our most vulnerable population across the entire CKD spectrum. And the phase three studies, which were all of the global studies where they look specifically at the incident dialysis patients, showed a 30% lower risk of MACE and a 34% lower risk of MACE plus among the patients treated with roxadustat versus those treated with ESA.
That's really remarkable, don't you think? I mean,
absolutely. I think this is really a game changer in terms of the treatment of anemia among that very vulnerable population. Now, of course, whether this will translate to a transition in terms of our approach to the management of those patients when we weigh all of the other issues that we've alluded to in terms of, you know, possible safety issues, in terms of access, in terms of cost. Obviously, all these have to ultimately go into the decision making, and we certainly want to individualize therapy and provide the treatment that's best for that particular patient, taking into account their comorbidities, their insurance, all of those other things. You know, I think we may be favoring roxadustat in many of those patients.
So let me talk for a minute then about the vadadustat efficacy in the dialysis population, because it's comparable, though not as dramatic a result as was seen with the roxadustat data. The dialysis-dependent trials, there were two large trials performed by using vadadustat versus darbepoetin. And as expected on efficacy, as you said, it's not inferior to ESAs over 100.
Hold on. I'm sorry. My cleaning lady is right outside my room, and you're probably going to hear the vacuum.
Dr. Quinn, I don't know if you can figure out a place to pick that up before you were interrupted.
I think I'm going to just start again with.
Sorry about that. I didn't think she was coming here.
Okay.
Tuesday is cleaning lady day.
Okay. Well, let me compare that data to the vadadustat dialysis-dependent CKD studies regarding safety. As you mentioned before, vadadustat was non-inferior to darbepoetin for treatment of anemia over 116 weeks of therapy. And in these trials, the safety of vadadustat was non-inferior or not significantly different than the safety of darbepoetin, with the median effect size or hazard ratio of 0.96 and the confidence intervals extending across one, so we can't say it's superior. Qualitatively, this is similar to what was seen in the roxadustat trials, but perhaps not as dramatic, and not the hazard, the HR or hazard ratio point is closer to one than with those products. What's concerning is what vadadustat saw in the non-dialysis population. Unlike with roxadustat, they went up against ESA therapy, specifically darbepoetin, in the non-dialysis patients who were anemic. And they found that in their two main trials, MACE was actually increased. The hazard ratio was 1.17, and the confidence intervals were 1.01 to 1.38, I believe. So we have a higher MACE with vadadustat compared to darbepoetin in the non-dialysis population. Jay, we can't really compare these results entirely to the rocks of dust that results, because they weren't looking at an active comparator. So what do you think accounts for the differences in this non-dialysis population?
I think that's a really good question, and I'm not sure anybody has an answer at this point. They did a sub-analysis, as you know, of the U.S. versus the non-U.S. Subjects in the non-dialysis study for vadadustat, and showed that in the U.S., there was not a significant difference versus the comparator. In other words, they achieved the non-inferiority, whereas in the non-U.S., that's where most of the problem was in terms of not achieving the non-inferiority. So part of the speculation is that in the non-U.S., where the comparator was, of course, an ESA, and the target range based on the product recommendations in the non-U.S. For hemoglobin was 10 to 12, whereas in the U.S. it's 10 to 11 based on the ESA package insert, that gave a perhaps wider range of hemoglobins, perhaps a higher median target. We don't know what the actual doses of vadadustat were in the U.S. versus the non-U.S. population, so we can't say that it was a dose effect. But certainly that dramatic difference between the results in U.S. and non-U.S. is cause for further investigation to try to get at what this issue might be related to. As you point out, it's comparing apples to oranges if you say, oh, you know, roxadustat must be safer than vadadustat in non-dialysis patients, because the roxadustat used a placebo comparator, and one could argue that the non-treatment of patients with anemia in the setting of CKD may itself be associated with bad outcomes, and therefore you're setting yourself a lower bar in terms of safety when you use that type of experimental method as opposed to in the comparator with vadadustat, which was an ESA. So one can't say that roxa versus vadadustat is more or less safe than the other agent in the non-dialysis patient population, unless there's a head-to-head study, which of course was not done.
It's also probably worth mentioning that these drugs appear to have different effects on LDL cholesterol. Roxadustat does decrease LDL cholesterol, and vadadustat does not. And that introduces the whole subject that these drugs are not identical. While they have a same basic mechanism of action, there are several prolyl hydroxylase prolyl hydroxylases that are present in cells, and these drugs have differential effects on which ones they're activating, and that can change the gene programs that they're turning on and off. Jay, do you want to cover or mention briefly where we stand with daprodustat?
Well, as I mentioned before, daprodustat just completed its global phase 3 studies, so all we really have is top-line data that met its efficacy targets versus ESAs in those particular studies where ESA was the comparator. And we have basically no safety data as of this point on daprodustat.
And daprodustat in the non-dialysis patients was against an active comparator also.
Well, there's actually one of the studies that had a placebo comparator in the ASCEND series of studies that daprodustat did. But yes, the major study with the most patients had an active comparator. Getting back to the mechanism and the difference of these various agents, which you brought up, Dan, there is a different pharmacokinetic profile to each of these agents. Roxadustat has the longest half-life. It's typically administered 3 times a week, whereas vadadustat and daprodustat have shorter half-lives and are typically administered on a daily basis. And it's also possible, in addition to there being a different specificity with regard to the prolyl hydroxylases that each of these agents may inhibit, is that the pharmacokinetics may be such that you're not getting the complete resetting of the gene activation for some of the non-erythropoietic genes. Because as we said before, you know, the ideal HIF stabilizer is going to just activate those related to erythropoiesis and not activate any other genes related to fibrosis or angiogenesis or cellular metabolism. And the ability to exert that specificity may in fact be related to its pharmacokinetics.
I think we're near the end here, Jay, so I'm gonna give my final thoughts. The first is the roxadustat versus placebo data was in really late stage CKD, mostly CKD 4 and even stage 5 patients not on dialysis. And I think that needs, the results need us to rethink our very low use of treatment of anemia in these late stage patients. Clearly treatment was beneficial to these patients on many levels. And I think we need to be more aggressive about treating them. I'm particularly intrigued in seeing the daprodustat data to see if the safety data parallels vadadustat or roxadustat in the non-dialysis population. And lastly, I think that the incident dialysis data with roxadustat, and we'll have to see about other agents, changes how we really manage new dialysis patients. We may move away from ESAs and go to what appears to be a safer agent.
I couldn't agree with those comments more. And one thing that we really didn't emphasize, again, with this improvement of the functional iron deficiency because of the decrease in hepcidin levels and increase in iron transport proteins, is that at least in the phase 3 studies of roxadustat, where they've done those analyses, the IV iron requirements decreased among the dialysis patients. And it's very, very possible that what used to be a requirement for IV iron may be met with oral iron compounds, which will have significantly improved absorption given the lower hepcidin levels. So again, I think there are many promising aspects of HIF stabilizer therapy above and beyond what we've been accustomed to with the ESAs, the fact that they're oral, the fact that they have beneficial effects on iron metabolism. We hope they turn out to be as safe, if not safer, than ESAs as the roxadustat showed in the incident dialysis patients. So I think we're at the threshold of a very, very exciting new era in terms of the treatment of anemia in patients with chronic kidney disease.
So thank you for listening today. We hope this podcast was informative. Please follow Kidney you knew I was going to mess that up. Please follow Kidney Colloquium on Twitter for a series of discussions through various formats, including more podcasts, tweetorials, live Twitter chats, and case study discussions driven by a rotating... And it's ended. I don't know what that means.
Rotating something.
It says driven by a rotating. I don't know what that means. That's all. That's on my script.
Katie, was something left out of the script?
Yeah, it's fine. You can leave it at that.
Okay.